from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the United Nations officially recognized Palestine as a non-member observer state last week. Meanwhile, Israel has announced plans to construct over 3,000 new housing units in the occupied West Bank. What impact will these recent developments have on the peace process, if the peace process is still going on, which it doesn't appear to be? Our guests will include George Bisharat, who is a former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council and now professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, and Andy David, who is consul general for Israel in charge of the Pacific Northwest region. Join us for Forum next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this opening Forum hour, we're going to divide the hour and hear points of view of two distinctly different narratives on the recent recognition by the United Nations of Palestine as a non-member observer state and on the more recent announcement by the Israeli government of a plan to build additional settlements. The plan, designated as E1, would mean the construction of nearly 3,400 units of new housing on the outskirts of Jerusalem. And in the second half of this hour, we'll be speaking with the new Israeli Consul General for the Pacific Northwest. But in this opening segment, we welcome to the studio George Bisharat, a Palestinian-American who is professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, and who also served with the Palestinian Authority, actually served, I should mention, as a former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. And George Bisharat, good to have you back on Forum.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Welcome to the program. I guess the place to begin is, I don't know if we can read the mind of Benjamin Netanyahu, but this de facto recognition followed by the settlements in many people's minds suggests retaliation by Israel, or do you think this was in the works all along?
Well, there's reason to believe that this measure may have been considered previously, and the vote in the United Nations really was just the trigger that enabled Netanyahu to go forward.
Well, let's talk about that trigger. I mean, in a sense, it seems to have wide support. It did have wide support throughout the world. And what does it do for Palestine? I mean, aside from possibly having more leverage with the Security Council or with the International Court.
Well, it doesn't have immediate tangible impact, but it does constitute a step in the direction of reintroducing international law as an important parameter to be considered in negotiations with Israel. It will enable Palestine to accede to a number of treaties that will enable it to better protect its natural resources, and it also will enable the Palestine to become a member of the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. And should it choose to proceed in that direction, those two courts might enable Palestine to actually begin enforcing international law and preventing Israel from violating international law with impunity.
Seems like these two recent news events have, if anything, exacerbated what may have been all kinds of impediments with respect to the Abbas administration and the Netanyahu administration. I mean, President Abbas has called this a red line, the settlements, and Benjamin Netanyahu certainly expressed a great deal of dissatisfaction, put it mildly, at the United Nations vote. I don't know if we really had a peace process, but does this, in your judgment, make things even worse?
It makes tensions greater for the time being, but I believe ultimately, in the long run, it will prove to be an important step forward. Now, the peace process, as it had been bumping along over the last 20 years, basically has achieved very little. It has enabled Israel to essentially triple the number of settlers, illegal settlers in the occupied territories. That includes the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and has not brought Palestinian freedom any closer. So, to the extent that we lose or move away from that kind of peace process, then that constitutes progress, not regression.
Well, you've even had United States officials being very critical of this recent move with the settlements. But Mark Toner, for example, from the U.S. State Department said, and Prime Minister Netanyahu said, we need direct negotiations. That's what we have to have.
Well, of course we need negotiations, and negotiations are the only way. There's no military solution to this conflict. There will only be a political solution, and it has to be negotiated. The question is on what terms and under what circumstances. Right now you have a militarily powerful state. Israel is ranked somewhere between, you know, fourth and sixth most powerful military in the world, and an economically powerful state. Negotiating with an entity that is not a state or has not been recognized as a state until very recently, and which has, you know, none of the guns and none of the power, and so this is a highly unequal kind of circumstance, and bilateral negotiations under those circumstances are simply going to reflect the imbalance of power between the two.
Well, there's a greater imbalance when you factor in Hamas, because when you're talking about the Palestinian Authority, of course, you're talking about now an observer state to the United Nations. But when you're talking about Hamas, talking about a group that is still labeled as a terrorist group and has and was sending rockets into Israel.
Sure. And the problem of Palestinian disunity is an important one, and it's one that the Palestinians themselves own and therefore must solve. That is an important impediment to progress, and that's all on the Palestinians' responsibility.
Well, do these settlements destroy, so the argument goes, a viable Palestinian state alongside of Israel?
I think it's quite likely that they have destroyed the possibility of a two-state solution. And they do so in a number of ways. So, you know, the settlements themselves are built on, to a substantial degree, somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% on private Palestinian land that has been confiscated by the Israeli government without compensation. The rest of the land is built on either state land or other land that the international community has recognized should go to a Palestinian state, to an independent Palestinian state. And between the settlements themselves, the actual land, the security areas that surround them, the roads that join them together, the electrical power grid that links them, and other infrastructure, a system of separate roads that only Israeli settlers can travel on, all of these things make travel within the West Bank for Palestinians virtually impossible. It means you can't go visit your grandmother. It means you can't get to your medical doctor. It means that your kids can't get to school. And it means that your goods can't get outside for export and the like. So it's basically smothering Palestinian life and making it impossible for them to live.
In fact, I think it's your position that the settlements are against the Geneva Convention. Therefore, I think you said this in an editorial you did in the Chronicle, they're
right.
War crimes?
Well, yes. It's not just me that says the settlements are illegal. The International Court of Justice, in its 2004 opinion finding the Israeli separation barrier to be illegal, also found that the settlements are illegal. And everybody knows that they are illegal. Even the Israeli government really honestly knows that they're illegal because its own legal experts told it so. Theodore Meron, who was a very distinguished international jurist, gave a letter to Prime Minister Levi Eshkol in September of 1967, when he was the legal counsel of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, that said very clearly civilian settlements in the occupied territories violate the Geneva Conventions. Now, under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, grave violations of the Geneva Conventions, including civilian settlement in occupied territory, constitute war crimes. So these are not only my personal opinions. That is the law.
George Bisharat is here with us at City Hayes, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. And if you've just joined us, we're going to be speaking with him right up until the break. And then Andy David, the new consul general for Israel serving the Pacific Northwest region, will be joining us in studio. If it comes down to a Security Council vote, the United States, actually on a censure vote against the settlements a couple of years ago, voted it down.
Correct.
Any prognostication about if it came to another vote where the United States might stand?
Unfortunately, my prediction is that the United States would do the same. It would again use its veto power to, as it has done some 40 to 45 times since 1973, will essentially protect Israel against the consequences of its illegality.
And what about the argument that Israel is, well, protecting itself? I mean, we'll hear from the Consul General later, and I don't know if that will be his position, but one could imagine with all those rockets coming in from Hamas and that land having been given up in Gaza by the Israelis, and the whole sense that, well, there's non-acceptance of Israel even as a state that goes back to the mandate in 1948, that Israel has to essentially become strong against its adversaries and those who want to destroy it.
Well, you know, all you really need to do is take a look at the map and how the map has changed from 1967 to the present. What you see is that Israel is inexorably expanding into the West Bank. That is not a form of defense. That is a form of colonial expansion. And if it, you know, this is not the way to defend a nation. That is a way to instigate rebellion and resistance, and that is exactly what has happened.
And when Prime Minister Netanyahu says that there's a glorification of violence in the world of the Palestinians, still very anti-Israel and great enmity against Israel and refusal to accept Israel as a state, you say what?
Of course. That is the response of people who are colonized. Now, Israel itself is a very militaristic culture, which glorifies, its soldiers and its military elites, and former military people play very prominent roles in Israeli politics. Unfortunately, that is the distorting effect on both societies of the resort to arms. Now, you know, I'm a person of the law and a person of peace, and my entire approach, and I think this is the approach I wish our politicians in Washington, D.C. would approach, is one based on the resolution of conflict based on justice and based on law. And those are tools which have been cast to the side, unfortunately, for the last 20 years, and which, as I said, the Palestinian move is possibly the beginning of a reintroduction of law into the picture in a way that I hope ultimately will be very helpful.
Let me open the phone lines and also invite listeners to join us. Many of you have strong sentiments about not only the recognition of Palestine, which occurred last week, but also what President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, has been calling the red line now with the settlements that have been certainly in the works as far as construction by Israel. You may want to join us, and you may have questions as well, and so feel free to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your calls. The number is 866-733-6786. If you'd like to talk to George Besharat, the time to do so would be now. We'll be talking to the Consul General of Israel after the break. Again, join us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. You can also post any questions or comments you have. And we welcome those on our website. The website is kqed.org/forum. And click on this particular segment or go to our Facebook page. And you can also tweet us. And our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Feel free to join in and become a part of this program, though. In fact, we welcome you. I'm wondering if we could, before we go to our callers and bring them into this, George, the Israeli decision to cut off cash transfers from the Palestinian Authority to the tune of about $100 million. Mm-hmm. These are taxes and customs money for the most part that were duties that were taken from the Palestinians. Now they're being used by the Israelis to pay off debts, presumably. How is this read, do you think, in the Palestinian Authority?
Well,
I mean, it's hurting, obviously.
Yeah, of course, it's hurting.
Do you see it as kind of an act of war, or how do they see it?
They see it as an act of petulance, I think, and spite. You know, they have simply won international recognition for their rights to freedom and dignity, and Israel responds by punishing them. I mean, this should be a day of celebration. In fact, if Israel had its own self-interest firmly in mind, they would also celebrate this vote.
Well, when President Abbas went back, he was greeted triumphantly and victoriously. Some were saying that this was really the last thing he had in his toolkit, that Hamas had won so much Palestinian, pride, I suppose, more than anything else, as a result of the rockets that went into Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Right. Yes, I think it was a last somewhat desperate move on the part of the secular nationalist Palestinian leadership. And the question remains whether ultimately it is going to lead to the realization of Palestinian national rights. Honestly, I don't think it will. I think it will lead to a process that will make clear that the two-state solution is unattainable at this point and that another solution is going to have to be found.
Well, let's go to our callers, and you might also want to comment, some of you who are listening, either on our website or on our Facebook page, on what you think the United States' role in all this has been. There has been some strong language from United States officials about the plan to go ahead with the settlements, and certainly all along President Obama has been strong in opposition to the settlements, and as many know and as many have commented on, his relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu is not the best. But let's go to your calls and find out what's on your minds. And Rebecca, you're first up here. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in response to the guest comment that Hamas's take on Israel's lack of recognition of Israel is somehow a response to colonialism or actions taken by Israel. I think that history makes it pretty clear that the terrorist elements of the Palestinians have never recognized Israel, even before there were any colonies or movements. In fact, it seems pretty clear that there are some, you know, maybe not all, in the Palestinian, you know, faction that are very certain that in their minds that Israel has no right to exist. How can that be explained away as some sort of response? And how can Israel possibly feel safe knowing that right next door there are some very potentially violent people who do hold that point of view? I'll be happy to take my answer.
All right, we thank you for the call, Rebecca. George Bisharat.
Yeah, so actually the question that had been asked to me was whether Israel was defending itself or not. And I was explaining that, in fact, Israel is expanding. And, of course, you have a violent response to colonialism, which is itself executed by and carried out by violence. As far as Hamas's Hamas's positions and Israel's response to Hamas, consider the fact that in 1991, the Palestinians sat down at Madrid across the table from Yitzhak Shamir. Yitzhak Shamir was a man who was a terrorist and who had the blood of Arabs and British and the Swedish diplomat Count Folke Bernadotte on his hands. The Palestinians sat down with him and negotiated. You don't have the luxury of choosing your opponent. Your opponent often is somebody who is not very nice, not very friendly, doesn't have a clean history.
Well, the PLO didn't have a clean history, and now they're willing or have been willing to some extent to talk with the Israelis, and some think that Hamas may go the same way, although there's no way to predict that.
Sure. Hamas, there's a handful of countries in the world, including the United States, Canada, Britain, and, you know, the Council of the European Union, that consider Hamas a terrorist organization. And there is a wide swath of humanity that considers Hamas a legitimate resistance organization, even though they may disapprove of some of its tactics. And many, of course, do. So, you know, Hamas, unfortunately, like it or not, it is part of the political scene and has to be contended with.
Well, in fact, here's a listener, Richard, who writes, wants to know whether you think the United Nations is effectively, or in effect, recognizing Hamas, not Palestine. I don't see how the UN can recognize people who hurl missiles at Israel, irrespective of the history of the region. It seems that this is an opportunity to withhold recognition until Hamas stops its activity. So there again is the link of the Palestinian people, I guess, in this listener's mind, between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. You recognize the Palestinian Authority, in effect, you're recognizing Hamas.
Well, in fact, the UN recognition was of Palestine as a non-member state of the United Nations. It wasn't a recognition of either the Palestinian Authority or Hamas. And no, I don't think it implies a support for either of those administrations of those two regions. And, you know, the state of Palestine was recognized in the areas that were occupied by Israel in 1967. So that included both territories.
I also want to read an email from a listener named Joseph and preface this by saying there was an article in the New York Times that spoke about a lot of applause in a synagogue in New York City when the observer status for Palestine was voted on and passed. And Joseph writes, Israeli and American warnings that the vote on Palestinian statehood sets back the peace process is complete bunk. I'm a pro-Israel Jew and the grandson of Zionist settlers from the first Aliyah, but I'm sickened by the actions of the Netanyahu government. Israeli settlements in the West Bank are the number one obstacle preventing peace, and anyone who believes otherwise is kidding himself. Let me go to some more of your calls. And you're welcome to join us by emailing us, forum at kqed.org, or by going to our Facebook page. This is Udi. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question to the guest speaker is, as someone, an Israeli citizen, who is a believer in the two-state solution, how do we deal with the fact that Israel pulled out of Gaza unilaterally, and we all see the results? As someone who is a believer in a two-state solution, I don't get my comfort level is very low, to say the least. If we start pulling out of the West Bank, what assurances do we have that we'll not start seeing rockets flying from the West Bank into Israel where there is zero strategic depth? I'll take my answer off the line.
Thank you for the question. George Bergeron?
Sure. Udi, if I got your name correctly, I understand your concerns, and I understand the concerns of many Israelis. I think their fears are genuine. I take them very seriously. But the withdrawal from about 8,500 Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip essentially was a move to solidify and extend Israeli control over the West Bank, and to intensify settlement there. And that's exactly what happened. And I do think that the danger of resistance, whether it be in the form of suicide bombings or rockets or some other form, will remain as long as fundamental questions of justice or injustice remain unanswered. So the solution that is going to give everybody the peace and security that they deserve, Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, is one that is fair to both sides.
With the precedent of Gaza, I'm sure you would concede there's really no way to assure the Israelis that if they abdicated and the land became occupied by the Palestinians, that there wouldn't be rockets coming through Iran or wherever else.
Well, it depends on the circumstances of that withdrawal. If fundamental Palestinian rights and interests are not addressed in a peace agreement, then of course there's going to continue to be resistance. So, we need peace based on justice, and if we don't have that, we're going to have continued conflict. That's just a rational that can be stated in purely rational terms. I mean, I personally believe justice is an important value, but even if you put that aside, when people feel that they have been treated unjustly for generations and they have had their fundamental rights denied, they fight back. And
bottom line here, because we're coming up to the end of this segment and we're going to hear from the Israeli Consul General next. You said you don't think that the peace process is going to move forward with this, that it's maybe halted things. Where's your optimism come from?
Well, I take a long-range view. And I think that there is increasing understanding on both sides. And it's very interesting. You see this even among some Israeli right-wing politicians like Reuven Rivlin and others. People are beginning to come to grips with the fact that Palestinians and Israelis are going to live together cheek and jowl for the future. And the only way for them to really live together peacefully is in a single state governed by principles of equal rights. And that view is taking greater hold.
We'll let it hold. We'll let it stand there. George Bergeron, again, is professor of law at UC Hastings College of Law, former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. Thank you for being with
us. Thank you.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And in this segment of Forum's opening hour, we welcome to our studio Israel's Consul General for the Northwest Pacific Region, Dr. Andy David, who has been at that position now for 4 months. And pleased to see you here. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Michael, for having me.
Glad to have you. I guess the initial question I have to ask you, with the overwhelming support of observer status for the Palestinian Authority, why was it wrong to recognize them by the United Nations, in your judgment, or from your government's judgment?
Well, yes, there was a support for that, but we know from past experience that there is an automatic majority for basically every move that the Palestinian would
in the General Assembly.
In the General Assembly, of course. So even if tomorrow they'll decide they want to move a resolution that is tomorrow is Saturday, not Friday, I guess they will manage to pull that.
Well, but from Israel's strategic point of view, how do they defend against that decision? Or what do they say would be really the reasoning against that decision?
Well, first of all, we're not against the Palestinian state. We are for the two-state solution. We just think that the way to do it is through direct negotiations. I don't think there's a good example in history where peace was achieved through the United Nations General Assembly. Peace is achieved through direct negotiations between the two parties. And by internationalizing that issue, I don't think we're moving closer to solving it.
Well, the argument now is with the settlements, the prospect of settlements being built for some 3,400 people or whatever, the likelihood of moving toward direct negotiations or any kind of peace process seems even more dim.
Well, we're talking about an area which is about a 2-mile area. And to be honest, I think that using the settlements issue has been an excuse for a long period of time not to come to the negotiation table. The Fatah movement was established in 1964. That was 3 years before the Six-Day War. The idea was to liberate Palestine all the territory of Palestine. Meaning, the problem is not Israel's expansion; it's Israel's creation. That is the problem. I feel that the Palestinians do not agree to, and that's the basic question we need to ask them.
Do you think there is cause and effect here? That is, that the settlements are a direct result of the vote in the United Nations?
Well, I cannot ignore the timing of that decision, but that decision, the E1 area, was discussed already by Prime Minister Rabin, then by Prime Minister Sharon, that's not a new issue. And by the way, the decision that was taken was not to build, but only to do, it's a permission to start doing zoning of that area, the E1. So it's not even one unit was permitted to build. We need to put the facts.
There are construction plans, though, are there not? I've actually seen some construction plans.
Not in E1.
Housing to go up.
Not yet. We're talking about zoning of that area and planning. So, yes, eventually, perhaps yes. But again, Israel is an expert country on removing settlements and removing villages and towns. We did that before. We did that when we had a peace agreement with Egypt. We did that in Gaza when we wanted to give peace a chance, as the song says. And peace did not arrive out of moving out settlements with Gaza. It did work with Egypt. It didn't work with Gaza.
Talking, if you've just joined us, with Dr. Andy David, he is, by the way, a DDS, a dentist, and also consul general for Israel, serving the Pacific Northwest region. The condemnations, though, of the settlement plan of E1 has been quite strong. Over a half dozen countries summoned Israeli ambassadors, U.S. officials, and the United Nations officials have condemned it. Israel's holding tough on this in spite of all this condemnation?
Well, again, the issue of settlements, I don't think that's the core issue. Let's say tomorrow we remove all the settlements from the West Bank. There is no Israeli left on any of those settlements. Will that bring peace, do you think? Will that stop rockets firing from Gaza? Will that stop attempts for terrorist acts from the West Bank? Will that make them recognize Israel's right to exist? That's a big question that I think every listener should ask himself.
Would you agree with, I guess you're not compelled to agree with your prime minister, but Prime Minister Netanyahu said that the speech delivered by President Abbas of the United Nations was an ethnic cleansing speech replete with hatred, and that sounds pretty strong to many people.
Yeah, well, let's discuss President Abbas for a moment. He already passed his election time, meaning that he's in a very comfortable position. Every president would like to be in that position where you don't go to election.
Bibi Netanyahu is not in that position. He has
not
to be reelected in January. Right?
He has to be elected. And since the Oslo agreements 20 years ago, we already had six prime ministers change in Israel. we are a nation, a republic of argumentative people. We like to change our prime ministers very often. We try the left, we try the right, we try the center. We're trying everything as people to move forward. I don't see that happening on the other side, unfortunately. And I hope that that kind of leadership will emerge on the other side, because from history we learn that when there is an honest and peace-loving leadership on the other side, like Egypt, like Jordan, a peace treaty will be achieved quickly.
Mahmoud Abbas said publicly that Israel, well, for lack of a better word, shafted him on this, that he was promised, I wasn't there, obviously you weren't there, we don't know that, but the implication was that he was going to have an assurance that the settlements would not move forward. And President Obama even seemed to be under that kind of suasion. So one has to ask now, is this in the best interest of Israel, particularly in light of the fact that things seem even more contentious with Hamas and Gaza?
Well, look, again, let's look at the facts. There was a 10-month moratorium on settlements. No house was built, no brick was moved. What happened in those 10 months? Mahmoud Abbas wasted that time. He just didn't want to sit with us.
Back in 2010, you're
yes.
talking about.
Yes. And, you know, we have to learn from experience. Is he willing to take that 15-minute drive to Jerusalem and sit down and talk? We are inviting him to do that. No preconditions. He will be welcomed. He's not doing it. He's spending more time on airplanes flying to the UN than talking to us. It's not the way to achieve peace. Let's look at the last country that has received statehood in the United Nations. That is South Sudan. They talked directly. They negotiated. They built institutions. They did everything a country needs to do in order to become a real country. Abbas is spending his time on fruitless efforts to get some kind of international support, which he gets. There are different interests in the world. If a country today, let's say a European country, wants to have a position on one of the UN bodies, it needs to get support from the Arab majority. Otherwise, they will not be able to get that position. So there are many interests there. It's a tough world.
Well, it's also a tough world for Prime Minister Netanyahu if he wants to be reelected, as we alluded to before. He has to, well, appear tough, particularly to the right wing and those in the Likud or the base of his support. So perhaps the position on the settlements is one that has political trappings behind it?
Well, in Israel, as I said, we are very argumentative. We have many opinions. Just read our newspapers and the criticism that we pour on our leaders. That's what democracies do. You do that here in the United States. We do that in Israel. Netanyahu may be the next prime minister, and he may not be. It's the people of Israel which have to decide, is he taking us the right way or the wrong way? And I don't think it's a story here. It's not a Western. It's not a good guy, bad guy story. It's more of a Greek tragedy where there are two narratives, two opinions, two dreams.
Two Semitic people who should be
friends, but we both have our dreams, and we know eventually that we will have to compromise on part of our dream in order to get the other part. The other part will be peace. We, time after time, tell our partners, the Palestinians, we are willing to compromise on part of our dream in order to get the other part. We're still waiting for them to say the same.
Does that mean, if I'm reading you right, that perhaps the settlements will move ahead with construction, perhaps they won't, but that Israel will be using this as part of a negotiation tool if it comes down to direct negotiations? Because certainly settlement building, in many people's judgment, is absolutely illegal in itself, by itself, and against international law. I don't know if you heard the last segment we do with George Basharat.
Yes, I did hear.
But he said it's even, you know, a violation of the Geneva Convention.
Well, I'd like to hear his opinion about firing rockets. Is that according to the Geneva Convention? Is that a good act? Let's talk a little bit more about the settlements. We're talking about just 6% of that whole territory, which is under dispute. Offers were made to the Palestinians on 97% of that territory. 97%. So 3% of that territory was under dispute. Still, they would not close a deal with us. We offered land swaps for that 3%. Again, that was refused. We're talking about the Olmert government, which certainly was not a right-wing government. We're talking about Yitzhak Rabin in the past. We're talking about Barak, who was a left-wing government. Those offers were made. There are American diplomats, Dennis Ross, who said clearly there were good offers on the table. They were rejected. Again, I don't think the problem is Israel's expansion to 5% or 6% of the West Bank. I think the problem is that there is not a willingness to accept Israel's right to exist.
Let me open the phone lines and also invite those of you who are listening to join us. You may have questions for Consul General David, and you may want to simply join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available, and we do welcome your phone calls. That number is 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to call us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. You're also welcome to post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us. Many ways to communicate with us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. There's an Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, which talks about implementation of the B1 plan, the E1 plan, and looking at their language here, that it will have far-reaching consequences, will interrupt the contiguity of the southern and northern West Bank, and they added the construction B1 will further increase the forced isolation between the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Well, I think there is an absurd claim there. Palestinians just got a state status from the UN. So building on 2 mile area, that will make that impossible. I don't buy that.
Even with the Palestinians presuming that East Jerusalem would be part of a second Palestinian or another Palestinian state?
Well, you know, I 3 weeks ago I was in Alaska. Alaska doesn't have contiguity with the rest of the United States. When there is peace with Canada, that is not a problem. If there will be peace between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israelis and Palestinians, those issues would disappear. If they are saying that that would be a problem, it means that they're not really thinking about peace. When there is peace, contiguity is not an issue.
Has Prime Minister Netanyahu on record as saying, and I wonder to what extent this is perhaps something that's negotiable, that Jerusalem cannot be divided?
Well, there were offers before about how to deal with the issue of Jerusalem. Some of them were very generous, not by our terms, but as described by...
Particularly when Ambassador Dennis Ross is...
Yes, Dennis Ross, and we talk about President Clinton, right. I would talk about the previous administration. There are many offers, and we are willing to be creative on finding the solutions for Jerusalem, for water, for refugees, for borders, for sovereignty, for economic issues, for customs. I mean, there are many issues we need to discuss. But let's start discussing them. Going to the UN and getting going back to Ramallah and seeing people clapping their hands. It's a nice week for the Palestinians. But it's an airplane that is taking off, and I'm afraid we'll have difficulties to land.
Well, Professor Basharat, who was with us earlier, didn't seem to feel that if things came down to a Security Council decision, for example, to halt the settlements, he felt the United States would veto that. But let's just suppose, for example, now with observer status, that the Palestinians were able to get something like that through. Would Israel flout a Security Council decision?
Well, let's talk about the principle. Let's say that the Palestinian Authority or Abbas becomes the president of a recognized United Nations state. There are 40% of the Palestinian population that he didn't see for 5 years. He's not going to Gaza because he's afraid. I invite Professor Basharat to go to Gaza and just after they listen to the interview he gave here. I'm afraid his life will be in danger because some of the things he said on this interview. He's welcome to Israel any day. I'll make sure to invite him personally. We're talking about a very distorted situation where there is no monopoly over the use of power. One condition that every government or every state must have is the monopoly over the use of power. Imagine in America you will have the Republican military forces and the Democratic military forces. You have private armies owned by political parties. How? I mean, that would be a very short... that the lifespan of a country like that would be very short. This is the situation now in the Palestinian territories. You have private armies owned by political parties. You have the Islamic Jihad, you have the Hamas, you have others. You must take control. You must get your act together. You need to build institutions. You need to invest in education and medicine and science, and not invest your money in building rockets or buying rockets or smuggling them. That's the issue. That's the core issue. If you get your act together, we will have peace.
Consul General of Israel, Andy David with us, serving the Pacific Northwest region. Let's go to your calls, and we begin with caller from Orlando, Florida. Bill, you're on.
Thank you very much. 2 points. First about Gaza, then about the West Bank. About Gaza, you mentioned that you left unilaterally. Well, when you left unilaterally, you surrounded it by the air, by the sea, by the land. By the air, there was drones all the time. By the sea, fishermen for a long time couldn't go out and fish, and they were shot out, and people were killed all the time. So that in and itself is an act of war. Secondly, in the West Bank, you say Palestinians should, you know, build institutions and recognize Israel. Well, the Palestinians did that in the West Bank. They recognized Israel. The PA did. They built institutions. They showed it to the rest of the world. And you know what's happened in the last 10 years? Settlement activity has tripled more than any other time. So exactly who doesn't want the peace?
Well, that's a good question. Let's talk about Gaza. When we left Gaza, we left greenhouses there. I remember I was involved in that effort. The idea was that Gaza will turn to be Singapore and it will be open. Unfortunately, Gaza didn't turn to be Singapore. Those greenhouses that Israel left behind were burned in the first week by Hamas people. Rockets were fired. So I guess you're right in a way that Israel did put some constraints. But it happened after, not before, Hamas started its violence against Israel. Number two, the West Bank. In the last 3-4 years, the West Bank has experienced an economic growth bigger than most of the Western countries. I'm talking about GDP per capita. I'm talking about imports, exports. We believe, truly believe, that if the West Bank prospers, it will be good for us. And we're trying to do a lot of things in order to do that. By the way, we not only left Gaza, we left also some settlements in the north part of Samaria. People tend to forget that. What did we get in return?
It left the Sinai, and now you have Morsi, who may or may not be belligerent where Israel is concerned, certainly hasn't even mentioned the word Israel.
Yeah, well, you know, in Texas or in California or in Illinois, it's easy to look from there and look at our region and say, you know, it's black and white. It's not. We're trying our best. And as a democracy, the people of Israel tell our governments what they think they should do. And if they don't do that, we change them. We don't wait for years. We change them quite often. It's not the same case on the other side. And I believe that when it's truly democratic, when there's truly economic prosperity on the Palestinian side, which we are willing to help, there will be peace.
They just withdrew $100 million, though, from the Palestinians.
Well, let's not forget that just a month ago, when they had some cash reserve issues, we transferred $80 million to them. We gave 50,000 permits, work permits for Palestinians from the West Bank to work in Israel. We have been trying, truly. We made agreements in the past with Turkey and with Egypt for free economic zones and with Jordan to help the Palestinians grow. We're not interested in having poor neighbors. We want to have rich neighbors like you do. We understand the path to peace. We proved that twice with Jordan and with Egypt. I think the burden of proof is on the Palestinian side.
Let me bring some more of our callers on, and we go next to you, Brian. You're on. Welcome.
Hi. No, I think Americans should have the perspective of what would it be like if our Indian reservations were firing rockets directly into New York and Chicago and San Francisco and Seattle. I think people wouldn't like it. And, I mean, it's a basic right to defend yourself. I don't understand why the Palestinians think they can fire thousands of rockets into Israel and not have Israel respond. It's nutty. The other thing I want to say is I think a two-state solution is terrible. I mean, I think if you look at history, what the coalition of Arabs, whether it's, you call them Palestinians or whatever, try to do militarily and propagandistically is to force Israel back inch by inch to the original settlements back from the original creation of Israel, to the point where they can then be such a small and isolated entity that they can then be pushed into the sea. They do not want Israel to exist at all, period.
All right, I thank you for the call, Brian. I want to get some emails on here, particularly since when we spoke to Professor Basharat, we didn't get to some of the emails. Actually, this came in with a segment with you, Consul General, but Rick writes, the guest from the first segment said that he believes in law. However, he speaks for an organization that uses terror as a tactic that is not lawful, nor should it ever be lawful. I believe that we are moving towards a future where terror rightfully will be handled like a bad dog and discouraged in every way possible. Palestinians must accept Israel as a state, stop promoting hate to their people, including their children, and stop all terror attacks. On the other hand, let's go to some other emails here from a different position. Keith writes, I've been embarrassed and disappointed for many years with the United States' unflinching support for Israel when it is clearly in the wrong. It seems we still haven't learned the lesson that supporting oppressive governments is not in our long-term interest. On the Palestinian side, I wish they would adopt the Gandhian method of passive resistance to colonization. Another listener, Glenn, writes, Israel militaristic? How many pictures of suicide bombers in Palestinian homes and areas? Hamas will never accept a Jewish state. Colonialism, 1947, the UN recognized the state of Israel, but Arabs did not. A one-state solution denies the Jewish people the right of their own state. There are many, many Arab states. Jordan is essentially Palestinian. And Seth's right, your guest claims to promote and uphold the law, but the Palestinian Authority is legally bound not to take unilateral action such as they did at the United Nations, but rather to engage in negotiations. How does he justify the PA's violation of this binding agreement which they had signed? And that's a question for George Burchard if he's listening. Question perhaps, Consul General, that you might want to respond to or at least give us your sense of.
Well, I hear how you read through all those emails, and I see that there's so many emotions involved, and there's so many people who take interest. So first of all, I'm honored that Americans take interest in my neck of the woods. I will say something different, maybe. I feel that there are different criterias. There's a certain criteria when it comes to international law and international reaction to actions when it comes to democratic countries. I think there's a different one when it comes to non-democratic countries, and I think there is a different one for Israel. We are held to a different type of standard. Let's talk about what's happening in Syria for the moment. Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Syria. Have you heard anyone complain about the death of Palestinians by Syrians? Not a word. If Israel is acting in self-defense and a Palestinian is killed, you hear everyone complaining about that, that Israel is aggressive, that Israel is disproportionate in its reaction. I think this is a very important topic for listeners to think about, the different criteria or the double standard issue.
I want to read some more emails, actually. Many of them on the settlements and that particular issue. A listener named Crony writes, it's hard to negotiate when your neighbors keep stealing from you. Stop the settlements and negotiations can begin. Jonathan writes, the whole mindset that the settlements aren't really the issue might be what your guest wants to think, but doesn't reflect the reality of anyone observing outside of Israel. Why are these settlement expansions so important to Israel? Is Israel growing so fast that a 2-square-mile settlement is so desperately needed that they don't care about the optics anymore? Clearly, it hasn't helped, so why continue at this tenuous stage, if not as a snub? Nelson says, aren't the settlements uneconomic because of the expenses of protecting them and the paths to them and the cost of transporting goods to and from them? Interesting, more pragmatic view. Mm-hmm. But you get the flavor here of
certainly a lot of
people just really saying settlements are not going to move toward peace. They're going to hold it up.
Yes. Well, I think that some of those opinions are also reflected within Israeli society. There are those in Israel who say that the settlements are a disaster. There are those who say that the settlements are a protective measure. There are those who say that this is a promise, a biblical promise. There are many dreams there. Some of them are religious. Some of them are pragmatic. Some of them are economic. Some of them are territorial. And some of them are just believing that this is an act of self-defense.
But the present leadership goes along with the idea that they're necessary.
Yeah, but there were other governments as well who were from different coming from a different position. Again, I'm saying let's look at history. when there was a peace deal made with Egypt, Israel removed settlements, removed cities, removed people, removed roads, removed everything. We know how to do that. We need peace. The peace is the answer. It's not the settlements. There was not peace before the settlements.
You know how some say, how can you have peace with, particularly thinking perhaps of Gaza, but the West Bank too, the inculcation of Palestinian children, a lot of it has to do with hatred against not only Israelis, but Jews in general.
Yes. Well, I think that's a very valid point. Let's look at the moment what happens in Egypt. For years, we had good relationship with the leaders of Egypt, while incitement against Israel was going on in the newspapers, in the textbooks, in the media. The thing is this: if you're not going to teach peace, if you're not going to create a culture of peace, one day as a leader you will be gone, and the rest of the people will be left with that notion of hatred, of assault against your neighbor. And I think that we need to pay attention to that. In the past, we tried to draw attention in the international community to what's happening in the textbooks in the Palestinian Authority. What are they teaching there? Does Israel has a right to exist in those textbooks? The answer, of course, is that Israel didn't have a right to exist in those textbooks. That martyrdom was taught in high schools and elementary schools. The public sphere was filled with anti-Israel feelings and incitement. It is important to teach peace.
On that note, thank you, Consul General. It's Andy David, Dr. Andy David, Consul General for Israel, serving in the Pacific Northwest region. Also thank George Bouchard again, who was with us earlier, former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and we're produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.